So the homeworks were good, pretty good. The first problem, which was this, the one where an allele is lethal both in home in a sex-linked case, both in the female as a homozygote and in the male as a heterozygote. People had a little more trouble with that than they did with the other one, which was the one with three haploid natural selection with three alleles where the frequencies were either going up or going down or up and then down. In the sex-linked case, most people got the equations correct, but some people assumed Hardy-Weinberg proportions, which is not generally true in a case like that, because natural selection is doing something different in one sex than it is in the other. So you end up with frequencies coming out of the two sexes that are not the same, and therefore Hardy-Weinberg officially doesn't hold. So you have to use the formulas for different gene frequencies in the two sexes. When you do, you find out that because all the little a's get killed off in the male, the male gametes are always capital A, which means in the females, except maybe for the first generation, but in the females, you have only big A, and heterozygote. So no actual elimination of little a's occurs in the females because there never are any. And then you can work out the formulas for gene frequency change. You work out that in the males, you always end up with a gene frequency of one for big A. And the formulas that come out, I believe the female frequency changes to be that the new frequency is equal to 1 plus the old frequency over 2, or no, 1, I think it's something like that. Correct me if I'm wrong. And basically what's going to happen is the female frequency of big A is going up. If you instead convert that to the gene frequency of little a, well, that's just 1 minus PF. So you get a QF prime, that's 1 minus PF prime, that's 1 minus this, that's equal to 1 half minus a half PF, which is a half of 1 minus PF, which is a half of the QF in the previous generation. So what happens is that basically half the little a's are getting killed off every generation. Their gene frequency goes down by half every generation. And that's basically because half of the time they segregate into males, they pass into a male and get killed. And the other half they don't. So it works out very simply, but a lot of people got confused. My formulation of the problem was not so great. I kept talking about the change of gene frequency. So some people took me at my word and computed the change of PF, which is okay. You can compute it. I gave full credit for that. I really would have been better off focusing you on the formula for the gene frequency as a function of the previous gene frequency. And some people did take it that way. I give credit for either. So there was that one. It's not an algebraically very hard problem, but it does require a little scratching of the head to figure out what it is that you have to compute. Questions about that problem? People can also see me about their individual papers, individual homeworks later, too. The other problem with three alleles, a lot of people got correct, and that, in fact, almost everybody. And you take the gene frequencies, you have a formula which says that the gene frequency is equal to the old gene frequency times its fitness over W bar, that's the haploid formula. You get that for two different alleles, and you take the ratio of those. I kind of coached you into doing that. And what you get is that that ratio gets every generation multiplied by the ratio of their relative fitnesses. It's very important here, by the way, These are relative fitnesses. Some people took them to be absolute fitnesses. And you get the right answer, but then you just assume that they're telling you that the population is actually growing, which it isn't necessarily. And then you find that happens every generation. Those are constants, so you could, if you go T generations into the future, you just raise that to the T. And people pretty much did that. And then you get those ratios, and then you have to figure out how to make them back into frequencies. And that's not hard. You really just get that the frequencies are one to something, and then you just say, let's divide by their sum. You know, their sum, they're going to have to be scaled, so they add up to one, so divide by their sum, and you get back to the frequencies. And then you find that the gene frequency of big A, the most fit one, is always going up. The gene frequency of little a, of A1 is always going up. Of A3, which is the worst of them, is always going down. And then A2 is, however, going up and then down. And I imagine that someone has told you that gene frequencies either ought to be good or bad, and they should either go up or go all the time or go down all the time. Is that true? You look here, you find for the generations ahead you compute, it's not true. The A2 goes up at first and down later. Then I asked you why, and answers varied. Some people said, because the algebra says that. Lots of you who are very algebraic and mathematical said, see, I did the algebra, it says that, that's why. Well, a biologist, I should have said in biological terms, because in biological terms, the reason is because A2, that allele, is at first competing mostly with individuals who are A3, who are worse, and so it's rising. But A1 is gaining and A3 is losing out. So after a while, A2 is competing mostly with A1s, and it's worse than them, so it then goes back down. And so you get to see that a gene frequency could do that. It could, if you're just watching that gene frequency, you might say, oh, here it goes, it's going up, it's obviously superior. Oh, wait a second, it's going down. Well, the environment must have changed. Well, in a sense it has. The mix of other genotypes has changed, and you're going down. So anyway, that's all for the homework right now. Another homework is due today. We're going to cover a little bit some of the math for that homework, but I urged you to read ahead and read some of fitnesses varying through time, the section on fitnesses varying through time, because that gets involved in one of the two problems for the homework due today. Let's see. Other questions before we plunge back into underdominance? Anything like that? I have set up a projector, a little projector we have from our lab, and with a projection at the back, so we're going to try this time combining projection and whiteboard without having to turn off, without having to lower screens up here and get the projector going. So let's see. Back there, what we had was a case of underdominance. I had also showed you a formula without completely proving it, though it's very easy to prove, which is this one, and I got it wrong. The change of gene frequency in all these insane cases of diploid selection is this, but actually I forgot there's a factor 2 down in the denominator, which doesn't actually matter very much. But you can take the gene frequency formulas that we had, say for over and under dominance, and this thing in brackets here is the derivative of W bar. If you take W bar and write it out, it's 1 minus SP squared minus T times 1 minus P squared. If I take the derivative of that, that is minus 2SP. Whoops. Plus, let's see if I get this right. Plus 2T 1 minus, no. Yeah, 1 minus P. I claim that to be the derivative. you'd have to sort of work through the rule, the rules for derivatives, and you'll see that this, the derivative of W bar, the mean fitness, so the slope of the mean fitness curve, this is the derivative of W bar respect to P, is just twice this thing in brackets. And that immediately verifies that formula. So the change of gene frequency is always, since P1 minus P is positive and so is 2W bar, its sign depends on the slope. And it will always be in the uphill direction, in an uphill direction. And I showed you that with some graphs. Let me remind you of them. And project back there. So looking back there, let's see. We have, flipping through, we were looking before at dominance and recessiveness, and then we looked at overdominance. And in overdominance, you're flickering a bit there. In overdominance, the curve goes, the change of gene frequency is positive below the equilibrium and negative above the equilibrium. So, and when you go forward and when you look at the change of gene frequencies, you see it converging on the equilibrium in the overdominance case from below and from above. And if you, and in the case of underdominance, however, it goes the opposite direction. So if you start a little above the equilibrium, it goes away upwards, and if you start a little below, it goes away downwards. And so the outcome depends sensitively on where you start. And if you start right at the equilibrium, in principle, it doesn't change, but that's impractical in real life because something will always jiggle, genetic drift or something will jiggle the gene frequencies away from the equilibrium. If you plot mean fitness in the overdominance case, we showed you that it goes up and it has its peak right at the equilibrium gene frequency. Not surprisingly, because the math I just showed you here shows that the place where the derivative of mean fitness is zero is exactly when this term is zero, and that's when the gene frequency doesn't change. So if you're at the equilibrium, you don't change. And to one side of it, you go uphill. And to the other side of it, you go uphill towards the equilibrium, and I decreed that it's known that in these cases you don't overshoot. You can prove mathematically that you don't overshoot. Okay. Underdominance, however, and we got to where looking at that you might say, oh well, natural selection is being optimal. Well, it's not actually being optimal because even in that case, what composition of the population would have the highest fitness? Okay, you may think of a way to have the population have as high a fitness as possible. It's overdominance.
Everyone's a
heterozygote.
Oh, yeah.
So in that sense, no, natural selection is not maximizing the mean fitness as high as it could. But unfortunately, Gregor Mendel gets in the way because those dart heterozygotes segregate gametes, and the segregated gametes combine at random and form homozygotes, and you're worse off. So even in this case, although you get to the highest possible mean fitness, it's the highest one you can have with genotype frequencies that start out before selection at in Hardy-Weinberg proportions. And, whoops, I went back. I'm always hitting the wrong thing. Now, however, you really can see that natural selection does not achieve perfection. If you look at this case, which is not in the book, which I just plotted this morning, and that's the underdominant case, which was the basis for those gene frequency changes I showed you earlier. It's exactly the same case. It's 1.15 in the homozygote, 1.30 in the other one, and 1 in the heterozygotes. The math is all the same with the T's and S's, but now the T's and S's are negative numbers. And the result is if you plot mean fitness, it goes down to the equilibrium and then up on the other side. And you can see that that fits those numbers, because when P is 0, everybody is a little a, and fitness is 1.3. When P is 1, everyone's a big A, and the fitness is 1.15. The vertical scale there, by the way, doesn't go from 0. It goes from just below 0.9. Yes?
Would you be more likely to see, like, diversifying selection in loci that had this behavior?
That had... I didn't catch the last couple of words.
In loci that where the heterozygote rate has the lowest fitness.
Well, the question is, just look at that. Is that diversifying selection? You've mentioned something called diversifying selection,
yeah.
Which we have
I
not.
I don't know if it is.
It looks like it is. That is, it looks like the population might want to get rid of the heterozygotes because they're not doing too well. And be composed of some kind of mixture of homozygotes. And the unfortunate problem with that is, again, Gregor Mendel. Those things are all part of the same mating population. They'll mate with each other. They'll create some heterozygotes, etc. In fact, you cannot maintain a population, just as you can't maintain a population that's all heterozygotes, you can't maintain a population that has a mix of the two homozygotes.
So there'd be really no way for each peak to, like, go off and do its own thing, because just one loci.
Well, I don't know what it means for the peak to go off and do its own thing.
Well, like, sometimes with diversifying selection, right, it can lead to a speciation event.
Let's leave that aside, okay?
Okay.
And let's just consider that we're at the moment in a single population.
Okay.
Everyone's mating with everybody. They're all the same species.
And
in fact, it's the fact that you're in Hardy-Weinberg proportions at the beginning of each generation that creates a situation where you can end up with a mix of both homozygotes. And the effect of it is that natural selection will climb the hill here. It'll follow this rule of going uphill. But which way is uphill depends on where you start. You start a little above the equilibrium, you go up. We saw that when the gene frequency curve was plotted. A little below and you go down. But then you see, you end up, depending on the starting point, you end up either here or you end up over here. But you can't end up both. You could have different populations doing this and ending up at different places, but one population will not. And the result is that you might say, well, look, it's going towards the optimal fitness. The optimal fitness would be everybody being little a, and they're all fitness 1.30. Well, that's actually relative fitness 1.30. But they could also go the other way. So you go uphill, but there is no part of this process that looks around, finds the highest hill, and says, let's go there. Instead, the population simply is if you anthropomorphize it, it is assessing the big A and little a alleles by which genotypes they're in and what their fitness is. If your initial frequency is low, a big A is low, the big A little A's are in heterozygotes mostly. So the rare alleles, again, are mostly in heterozygotes. The little a are mostly in the homozygotes, so fitness 1.3. So little a looks like a winner. Little a is reproducing more, the gene frequency of big A will go down, and you'll climb the hill. If, on the other hand, you start out over to the right, big A's are mostly in heterozygotes. No, let's start again. If you start out to the right, big A's are common. They're mostly in homozygotes and have fitness near 1.15. Heterozygotes have fitnesses, the little A's are in heterozygotes and have fitnesses 1. So big A's are favored, and you climb this hill. And you end up at a fitness that is not the optimal fitness. So the announcers on all those nature documentaries are completely wrong. It's not true that nature looks around, finds the perfect way to have predators, the perfect way to have prey, the perfect way to have adaptation to the environment in general, and then implements that. And I feel a little annoyed that generations of kids are growing up being told that. And they're going to have to get into schools where, I don't know if the teachers will emphasize this point, but they ought to. Because what it says is that, unfortunately, all is not for the best in this best of all possible worlds. That's a phrase that all is the best for this in this best of all possible worlds. Let's see how literate you are. It's actually somebody I've never read. It's from who? All is the best. All is for the best in this best of all possible worlds. It's spoken by a character in a novel.
Candide,
which is written, a novel written by
Voltaire
in the late 1700s, and his character Candide, who is a naive innocent, is being there's a professor Pangloss, who. Is lecturing him about how all is the best in this best of all possible worlds. Pangloss is thought to be based on the German philosopher and mathematician Leibniz, or Leibniz, however his name is pronounced, who said things like that. And the whole novel is about how Candide is disabused of this by one disaster after another. So natural selection is getting you better, but not getting you to an optimal phenotype. So we are not optimal phenotypes. And I always like to say that if we were, if natural selection could instead look around the surface of fitnesses as a function of all the gene frequencies and the haplotype frequencies, it gets complex, and find the highest peak and put us there, we wouldn't look like us. We would be able to fly through the air at 500 miles an hour, dive down, bore through solid rock, all the while composing sonatas. Okay. Unfortunately, here we are, and we're us, and we aren't that capable, but we do well enough. What is, however, going often uphill, not always, population genetic machinery, you go uphill a lot, but you don't always go uphill. In these simple two allele, in these simple one locus, two or more allele diploid cases with constant relative fitnesses, you can show that the mean in an infinite population, so things are changing deterministically, you can show that W bar continually. It never decreases. It increases till it can't increase anymore. But in this case, it may be climbing it's climbing the nearest hill. The analogy that I always like to use is if we suddenly heard that a giant flood was coming, we would, of course, like a tsunami, we would jump up, run out the door. We would not look around on the surface of the earth and find what's the highest place and go to the top of Mount Everest. We wouldn't do that. We would run out the door and start running furiously across campus. And you would run across the campus. You would emerge at the top of campus on 17th Avenue. You would go up 17th Avenue until about 55th Street, and then you're at the local maximum. There are higher places in Seattle. The highest is Maple Leaf Hill at about 92nd and 15th or so, 92nd and 13th or something. But you wouldn't go there. You run up the nearest hill. And that's what natural selection, changing gene frequencies, is doing. Well, I should stop belaboring that, but I think it actually makes an interesting point. There is one important case for underdominance that does occur. And that, we don't know too many loci that have underdominant patterns of fitness. They may be out there, but we don't know them. But chromosome rearrangements can, when you get a case where there's been a chromosome inversion, let's say, or it can also happen with translocations, with other rearrangements of chromosomes, and you have a diploid individual that has a regular chromosome and an inverted chromosome. Recombination between those can result in duplications and deficiencies, or also in a bridge fragment segregation when the gametes try to segregate. So a certain percentage of the gametes coming out of a chromosome heterozygote, not a locus heterozygote, but structurally heterozygous for that chromosome rearrangement, will get lost. So heterozygotes have a depressed fitness. Either of those chromosome orderings of genes on chromosomes, however, if a homozygote is okay, because everything pairs nicely if there's a crossover, it's just a crossover and nothing exciting, no gametes get lost. So the chromosome homozygotes are okay, the heterozygotes are often underdominant. And so this kind of dynamics is actually important in thinking about chromosome rearrangements. And that's all I'm really going to say about that. So where I want to go from here is to, I want to skip over a couple topics that are in the notes. One of them is, there's some stuff on multiple alleles, patterns of over and under dominance in multiple alleles. And it talks about sickle cell anemia and plots out what the fitness surface looks like, and that's interesting. But I'm not going to cover it here. There's also material on frequency-dependent selection, which is a case where the relative fitnesses, let's keep in mind the distinction between relative and absolute fitnesses. The relative fitnesses of two alleles depend upon the gene frequency. And a simple case for that might be, for example, you're adapted to eat larger. One allele makes you adapted to eat larger food. One allele makes you adapted to eat smaller food. The heterozygote might be eating medium-sized food. If the population has prey items that are both large, there are large and small ones, and you put the population out there with a high frequency of the allele that eats large prey, at first, both alleles will be doing fine, but finally the large prey might get kind of eaten up, and then there's mostly small prey, and then the other allele has an advantage. So you can get into a situation where an allele that's rare has an advantage because its food hasn't been eaten up as much. And so you can actually have not overdominance, but just a rareness making an allele more fit, and commonness making it more fit. In order to do that, though, you have to have the relative fitnesses be functions either of the gene frequency, or here it would be more complex. It's the functions of the prey item distribution, and that, in turn, its dynamics is affected by the gene frequency. Those are interesting cases. They're another way that you can have that frequency-dependent selection, in addition to things like overdominance, is another way that you could have balancing selection in a population. But I'm going to skip over that. There's a little bit of algebra in the section here. And I'm going to go straight ahead to another case, which is fitness depending upon population density, where it turns out that the population density, genotype that can survive at the highest population density does best. But I want to go ahead to fitnesses varying through time, because there's something that they lead to an intuition that turns out not to be quite correct. And they lead to us thinking about mean fitnesses in ways that are different from what we might intuit. So let me start there. And what I want to do is think about, first of all, about haploids. And then we're going to convert that thinking into statements about diploids by considering the case of rare, of one or the other allele being rare. But let's start with a case where we have, let's say, two environments, hot years and cold years, and we have an organism with discrete generations that has one generation per year. And you go along, and some years are hot and some years are cold. And let's suppose that in that case, the fitness scheme were that big A is favored in hot years, the relative fitnesses are 1.2 to 1. We won't worry about absolute fitnesses. In cold years, let's see if I get this right. I'll make it 0.81 to 1. We're just choosing, in each year, we're choosing little a as our standard. And then we're going to have a mixture of, let's say, 48%, I'll say how often, for 48% hot years and 52% cold years. Okay, so we're having a mix of hot and cold years, and we have those fitnesses. And then I say, okay, folks, what happens? What's going to happen? And I think what you have to do is think about the fact that the gene frequencies, what I'm going to do is take the ratio of the two gene frequencies, P big A, over P little a, because that the formulas are easiest in that case. And we know that in generation one, there will be, you'll take the ratio that you started with and multiply it by the fitnesses in that year. And what I'm going to do is just put a little superscript in parens of on the fitnesses, because the fitnesses now are going to vary from year to year. And so there it is. You go forward one generation. Then you might say, well, what about if I go forward two generations? Then I have another ratio that's applied to the front of the formula, the ratio of fitnesses in the next year. And the nice thing about, as we remember, about haploid selection, haploid cases, this would also hold for asexual clones, is that the relative fitnesses don't depend on the gene frequencies. In diploid cases, they do, because the mean fitness of big A's is a mixture of the performance of homozygotes and heterozygotes. But here we're in the haploid case, and every generation we're getting another ratio applied, whatever are the fitnesses in that generation. And finally, if I go for T generations into the future, you get that. Okay. And then that will be the ratio over here. And you may look at it and say, well, that's fine, but it still didn't tell me what's going to happen. Okay. Now, however, we can start thinking about what that will look like. One way of saying is it's going to be a product of WA terms, some of which are these 1.2 and some of which are these 0.81. And about 52% of them will be 1.2s and 45% of them will be 0.8. And in the denominator, they're all ones. So that's easy. Now you might say, okay, but still what do we expect? And here, now in the homework, we have a case. It's actually, was it a diploid or a haploid case? I'm forgetting. It was diploid. Okay. Yeah, it was, okay, diploid. In the diploid case, what we're going to see is that when you have a gene frequency near zero or near one, then the fitnesses of big A's and little A's will mostly be the fitnesses of two genotypes, the ones that those alleles are found in when the gene frequency is very common, or the ones that are it's found where the gene frequency is very small. That's where we're headed. Whether we'll get there before the end of the hour can maybe doubt it. And you'll find this in section 2.10 in the notes. You can read through it and you'll get this. You might be tempted to say, let's figure out the average fitness of big A's in the numerator, because that'll tell us what's going to happen. And if you just do an average like most people do, a weighted average and say 48% times 1.2 plus 52% times 0.81, what do you get? Well, you get, you pull out the calculator. Sometime I'm going to bring you down the calculator we have in our lab from 1970, which can add, subtract, multiply, divide, and do square roots, and has two registers to store numbers in. It's electronic, and it cost my lab in 1970 $1,340, which in today's money is more like $6,000 to $8,000. Okay. However, the calculator on my phone is just as capable as that one. And I just looked, and you could still buy little handheld calculators, so the approximate value nowadays of those functions is $3 to $5. Okay, now there is a calculator. Here it goes. So we get 0.48 times 1.2. That's 0.576. I always get the storing of numbers wrong, so let me just go. 0.52 times 0.81. That's 0.4212. And the result is 0.9972. Anybody, did I add properly? 0.9972. So then we might say, well, the average, the arithmetic average of these is a little bit less than 1. The arithmetic average of these is 1. Maybe that means big A will go down in frequency. But if you sit and think about it, and actually I think it will turn out that that in the end is the answer, but not for this reason. This is the wrong calculation. Why is it the wrong calculation? Well, what we're going to do is take logarithms just to make life hard for everybody. And we're going to take the log of this ratio is the log of this thing on the right. And so I claim the log of, or let's go log sub, I think ln of the ratio of gene frequencies in generation T is equal to what? Well, it's a log of a big product. So a log of a product of anything is the sum of the individual, of the logs of the individual terms. And I claim then it's the ratio in each generation. This is the one in the teeth generation. You take the log of that plus the log of the ratio in the generation before it, t minus 1, and so on, plus dot, 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 plus all the way down to the log in the first generation, which was the ratio in generation 1, plus the original log of the ratio of the gene frequencies that you started with. Okay. Is everybody okay with that? I took the log of a big product of ratios and I just got it out as the sum of the logs of the individual terms. Okay. And now, what we can see is, as you go forward through time, you're adding a number that's going to vary depending on the weather. It might be the term for a hot year, or it might be the term for a cold year. So there, here, you've got T terms, and their average is average, well, it will vary. It'll depend. You might get a run of hot years, and the average will be closer to the ratio to the value for hot years. You might get a run of cold years. But the expectation of one of them, let's say the expected value of a term is the average of log, let's see if I get this right, a log in a hot year, I'll put it super H, and the log of the ratio in the cold year, but I haven't put any pluses or minuses or anything here yet. But what is it? Well, it'll the average value of one of these is 48% of the time this and 52% of the time that. So you're adding a quantity, it's stochastic. If you take a scale, which is the log of ratio of big A to little a, you're starting somewhere on that scale. And then what you do next depends on whether it's a hot or a cold year. And so if hot and cold years are just coming at random, what would those frequencies, 48 and 52%, 48% of the time, you move upwards on the scale because you get the log of 1.2 over 1, which is a number, a positive number. Log of a number greater than 1 is positive. 52% of the time, you go the other direction, the log of 0.81 over 1. So you're going to jump either up or down. You're going to take a random walk. And it will depend upon the sequence of hot and cold years. Now, you have to consider, on average, what will you do? Well, first of all, what will you do in individual cases? The answer is you'll wander up and down. And sometimes you'll end up, and sometimes you'll end up down after two generations. Then you have to say, well, okay, that means we can't predict. But we can predict statistically. We can say, if we go on long enough, what happens? And this is where you have sort of gambling mathematics, casino mathematics. This is actually, it's the mathematics of gambler's ruin. People started, you know, mathematicians started working on this in the 1500s, 1600s, mostly in the 1600s and 1700s and on, because they wanted to know how to win at gambling. And it was a big economic, I mean, today you might have, you know, mathematics for national defense or something like that. But in those days, the hot economic application, or mathematics for winning in the stock market, which looks like this, by the way. But in those days, they wanted to be of service either to themselves or to patrons who were gamblers. And what you find out is what you will find out if you go to a casino and gamble. That if you have a game on which there is a probability of going up in your holdings, winning, but a slightly greater probability of decreasing. And we do, let's say we did independent trials. I didn't say whether these things were independent. But let's say we did independent trials. You know what will happen. You go into that casino with your $1,000, and you come out of that casino with considerably less than $1,000 most of the time, and the casinos stay in business doing that. They stay in business by calculating this thing. And I still remember my family went, I went with my family to a reunion on one side of the family, which they held in Las Vegas, not because they like to gamble, but because that's where you can get cheap hotel rooms. And by the way, Red Rock Natural Reserve east of Las Vegas is absolutely beautiful place to hike. Yeah, we did that. We did not spend a lot of time in casinos. But my wife claimed that as we went into the Las Vegas airport, she looked around and said she claimed to be able to see that the people arriving were delightedly happy and the people departing were less than happy. I don't know that I could detect that. But so if you compute this thing, you're computing the average change, and you don't do it by simple arithmetic averages. you do it by this thing, and what will that be? It'll be, I think we'll just finish off with this, and I'll tell you that to do the homework, you have to think about the math of being either at a high gene frequency or a very low gene frequency, in which case, in that limit, it looks like this. And it says this in the section in the notes. 0.48 times the log of 1.2, the ratio of those is 1.2, plus 0.52 times the log of 0.8. So let's try to do that on the calculator, which can be done. And we get, let's see. I clear it. We go 1.2. We take the log. Nope, I have to do it the other way. Okay, log of 1.2 for ran times 0.48. And I get 0.08751434.72. This is being ridiculous, but okay. That's the first term. The second term is log of 0.8. Log of 0.8. And that's parenthesis times 0.5. This is 0.52, actually. 0.52, and we get minus 0.11603464.6. I'm going to be 0.875143472, and we get minus 0.02852 and some stuff. So what does that mean? It means that on average, on this log ratio scale, you're on average going to the left. But in individual years, you go up or down. Now, I think in the homeworks we talk not about random fitnesses, but cyclical fitnesses, where each year there's a spring with one set of fitnesses and a fall with another, and it's rigid. And you'll see, here I will show you such a case. Sorry to run a few seconds over, but we'll stop in a moment. Where we have a haploid case. This is actually a haploid case. And we have fitnesses, the relative fitness of the big A are 1.5 in wet years and 0.6 in dry years. And you'll see both cases. The big black line is a random sequence of fitnesses with equal frequencies of wet and dry years. And it goes down and up and down. But on the long run, it's going down. But the cyclical case, which just says a wet, a dry, a wet, a dry, it's the same calculation. It's the log, the products just have exactly equal frequencies of up and down in that case. In this case, it would be a 50, it would be different. It would be, you have to do with 52% of your life cycle going up and 48% going down, which is a little, this is easier to think about. And there you'll see they oscillate up and down. They're going up and down, but the downs are bigger than the ups. And it's because of exactly this calculation. And so they too are going down and getting lost. Because this weighted average of logs and ratios calculation gives the same average number, it's just that it's stochastic with an average of that, like a gambling casino in one case, and in the other case it's rigidly going one and then the other one and then the other one and then the other. So I'll stop there. If anybody came in late and did not pick up their homeworks, please come and see me. If you want to know more about how to do today's homework, read section 2.10.